Welcome to Horangi Cybersecurity's Ask a CISO podcast. Come with us as we take a deep dive behind the scenes with the world's top cybersecurity leaders to get insights into security issues you care about. Before we take off, please help us grow by taking just a few seconds to like and subscribe to the podcast on YouTube, Spotify, and Apple Podcasts, and leave us a review letting us know what you think of the podcast and how we can improve.
Hi, and welcome to the Ask a CISO podcast brought to you by Horangi Cybersecurity, your partner in helping you navigate the choppy waters of cybersecurity and getting your company where it needs to go. I'm Mark Fuentes. I'm your host today. And today I have with me another amazing guest, Anant Srivastava, right? I hope I'm pronouncing that right, Anant?
Yes.
We are so happy to have him on board here today. Lots of knowledge, lots of experience here. Anant has been in the information security industry for over 15 years. Lots of corporate experience and expertise with network security, networking technologies, mobile, application security, and really big in Linux security as well. Anant is an avid open source supporter and runs multiple open source projects, prominent of them being Tamer Platform, which I believe is an Android platform, and Code Vigilant. He's really big in contributing in the open source communities as well, like Null, Garage Hackers. I think I'm pronouncing that right.
Yeah, Garage for Hackers.
Oh, I'd say that again, or not?
Garage for Hackers.
Garage for Hackers. And he's also helped establishing local chapters in his hometown, Null Bhopal and OWASP Bhopal as well. So welcome, Anant. Thank you for being here.
Thanks a lot for the introduction, Mark. Pleasure to be here.
We're super excited to have you, super excited. You know, one thing we like to do, especially with experts like yourself who've been in the industry for a while, but didn't necessarily start here, because most of us who've been here for a while didn't start here, right? The field is probably not as old as we've been working. So for those out there, maybe you could give us a little story about how, you know, what you did before and how you got into information security.
All right. So I think with computers, I've been involved since about 2000 onwards. And I started with Linux more of as a curiosity and more of as a challenge, because my school teacher basically said, hey, this is something a lot of people don't know about, but those who know about it are sort of intelligent people in the community. So that was kind of a challenge where I started with Linux. 2008 is when I graduated. And before that also, I was more focused around server administration, management of systems, more focused around Linux admin aspects of things. So my first role was around server administration kind of profile. But that was something where there were multiple bottlenecks coming up. Like, most of the stuff that was there in India was more of like, we are managing US servers, or we are managing servers for US UK clients. So effectively, you do late night jobs, you do overnight jobs, and those sort of things.
All of a sudden type thing.
Yeah. Then that's where we were like, that's where I started thinking, okay, what are the other options? And when I started looking at it, most of the folks around me were moving into programming, or were leaving the IT in general and moving into something which is non-IT. I was like, IT is sort of in my blood. I can't leave IT. So it has to be IT. And programming was something I didn't wanted to jump right away as a professional career point of view. And what I then realized was that although I have secured servers, I've configured servers, I've worked towards making sure people can't attack it, there is another side of the equation, which is around 2010 is when it started popping up, that hey, there is a professional requirement of people to break things. So I was like, okay, interesting.
I've been securing.
So how can I start breaking things? And that's where I started looking up at job opportunities. And initially, I did not directly started with pen testing as the security field. I joined a company where I was doing log review and log monitoring, basically. So there were about 5,000 assets that they had, and all of them would be sending in their logs, ranging from database servers to firewalls to systems sending their firewall logs. And our job was to ensure that nothing bad is going on. Mm-hmm. And while we were looking at that, I started encountering another area, which was correlation, which has been a very interesting aspect to look at. And we've been able to successfully correlate things like, by looking at your WebSense firewall log, I can tell you which machine is infected with a malware or with a Trojan on it. So those sort of weird correlations at that time, that also helped us do a proper inventory of the system. And right around 2010 and 2011 is when I first moved into a pen testing kind of a role. So that's where I started looking at web applications and networks as a pen testing target. Mobile has been something that I developed as a skill on my own as a side hobby. So around 2010 is when I got my first Android device. Mm-hmm. And I was like, okay, this is a fun device to have. And I think by that time, Backtrack used to be there. So I basically was the first person who ported...
We didn't call it Kali yet back then.
Yeah, yep. Yeah. So I was the first person to port the Backtrack image. So Backtrack at that point released a version for only a specific Motorola Android device. No other Android device was actually supported. And there was a very minor configurational flaw that was there. So I was the first person who corrected that flaw, got it working on mobile devices, or rather normal phones. Oh, wow. And that point onwards, it has been a fun journey with pen testing, breaking systems. And I think around 2016-17 time frame is when I started pivoting across to, hey, I'm not only going to break things, but I also want to secure things. I also want to help people get the security angle right. And that's where my previous experience has been helping me. So that's kind of the journey that has been.
So you you dipped the toe in the blue, moved right into red, and then backtracked back and became purple.
Yep.
All right. That's a unique path, actually. That's great. I've always looked up to myself. My background is almost entirely blue, all defense, right? I've done pen tests here and there in the past. I've been there playing with Backtrack, Backtrack 2, Backtrack 3, and then Kali and Burp Suite, right, whatnot. But I've always come back to blue. And so I always have a great admiration for people who can be purple, people who can actually be strong at both, because it's just not, for some reason, breaking things doesn't click with me. I'm not able to do it as well as I do building things. And I really have great admiration for folks like you that can master both sides. Definitely something I look up to and a little jealous of, But that's very cool, very cool. Like you were saying, at the time, you were saying you didn't feel like you wanted to move into programming just yet out of IT. Was anything in particular stopping you from moving at the time?
Not exactly anything in particular, but more of like server admin or playing with the whole environment, having that control over the environment was something that I craved for.
Even when you look at the God complex. Has a little bit of a God complex, huh?
Yeah. But not exactly. Even when you say attacker, or even when you say purple teaming, we are people who have sort of a control or the visibility over the entire environment.
That's right.
Programming at that point, or what roles I was able to get, was more of around, you will be responsible for writing this one part of a very big module, not even the whole program.
The siloed, the siloed nature of it.
Yep.
You're more of a big picture thinker.
I need to see what the whole picture is, and then even if it means I need to work on a small thing, I need to know the whole picture.
Okay. All right. Yeah, I can see that. I can definitely see that. So, as you said in your story, you know, you started as an admin, you understood infrastructure really well. Then you moved into understanding, you know, the defenses, how to break down defenses. You moved into mobile. And so eventually, even though you fought it, you ended up moving into more dev type things, more programming, which leads you into a place where you're quite prominent today, DevSecOps, right? And so tell me about that, the move into DevSecOps. How did that go for you?
It was a fun coincidence, I would say. So back in my previous role, we were doing a lot of pen testing work, and we were also delivering training sessions to people. So my previous company, Not So Secure, is one of the prominent Black Hat trainers. So we used to teach infrastructure, web application, cloud security trainings. The stuff that always irritated me was the fact that a pen tester basically tells you there are problems, and they would not have a clear-cut solution to the problem. Mm-hmm. Most of the reports that you see are more of around, hey, you need to read your documentation, or you need to figure out your company policy, how you want to fix that thing.
That's true.
We are not going to give you the recommendation. And I was like, at one side, this is good, because you're not taking that responsibility on yourself and screwing it over, but you're also copping out.
I wouldn't say it's a cop out. I mean, working with a lot of pen testers, and this is not anyone's fault in particular.
Exactly.
I think it goes back to my original statement, which essentially most people are strong at one or the other, right?
Yep.
So a lot of pen testers today in the field, they're really strong red teamers. They're very good at breaking things, but they're not good at building things. So their findings are essentially like, yeah, I broke it, and I don't know how to fix it, actually. I think it's not on purpose. I think in general, it's not on purpose.
Yeah, I mean, I won't say it's on purpose, but that was a gap that I was looking at. Yeah, it does not sit well with me. Hey, why can't I actually be in that position where I help people in actually fixing this also? So that's kind of the starting point. But then somewhere around 2018 is when our company got acquired by another company called Clarinet. And because of this whole acquisition, we were now part of a bigger set. And the other part of the equation was more around blue teaming, was not exactly around blue teaming also. They were more around deployment and application development. Mm. So they did not have that kind of a security side of things. So we were going to bring in security, which means internally we would have to teach them how to do things. And that's where I was like, okay, now I can cure my itch.
Yeah.
My itch being able to solve people's problem. And I think somewhere around that time, Halvor Flake, another prominent personality in InfoSec, actually did a keynote in Black Hat Asia, I think. And one quote of his actually resonated a lot with me. His quote was, "The offensive problems are technical in nature. The defensive problems are political in nature."
Oh, that's great. Oh, that's so good.
Yep.
It's so true.
Yes.
It's so true because, you know, and, you know, for those out there, you know, me and Anat are geeking out about it right here. And if anyone is missing the joke, you know, what we will always run into is pen testers will come in and they'll find technical problems, right? And they'll say, okay, well, you need to make these changes in these configurations. And once we ask for permission to make those configurations, someone says, well, it works the way it is. Don't change it, right?
Yep.
We will accept the risk. Just don't change the way it is, right? So, wow, that's a great, great quote to me. Let me just repeat it back so I can steal that from you and the keynote speaker. you said that offensive problems are technical in nature, and defensive problems are political in nature.
Yes.
Oh, so good. I love it.
So
definitely gonna steal that.
Those two things were kind of the lead-in for me to start into this journey. That's when I was like, okay, let me leverage all what I've learned in the entire time span. And even though I was doing offensive work, even though I was doing all this stuff on the red side of things, I think since 2007, I've been maintaining my own servers. All the projects that I've talked about, I've been self-hosting them from that time onwards. So I've always been in touch with the admin side of things. So it was an easy time for me to say, okay, yeah, this is the attack part, this is the defense part, let's just start merging them. And that's where cloud also helped, because the whole journey of moving infrastructure to infrastructure as code has been an instrumental part of the whole DevSecOps paradigm as such.
I think so as well. Prior to these cloud migrations, prior to a lot of that, I've always had an itch myself when people say DevSecOps. I actually get a little annoyed about it, because it's my opinion that if you're a proper DevOps person, you will care about security.
Yep.
So when people say DevSecOps, I'm like, well, is it really DevSecOps, or is it just proper DevOps?
Yeah.
Yeah.
In one of my talks about DevSecOps, this is how I actually started. DevSecOps is a term that should never have existed.
It should never exist. Yes, we're on the same page. It should definitely not exist, because DevOps should be secure.
Should be secure by default. Yep.
Yes. And that goes back to another buzzword, secure by design, right? And that's why, yeah, I get a little annoyed when people talk about DevSecOps.
As if
security is a brand new thing that wasn't invented since the beginning of time, right?
But I think it's that market cycle. Market needs a new buzzword every few years. It's generative AI right now.
That's kind of interesting that you bring it up that way, because both of us were practitioners, right? Sometimes I have this desire to divorce the salesy part of security from the practical side, right? And I'm sure have felt the same thing in the past. And I guess this next question has to do with that, but it also has to do with the quote that you gave me, right? Because really, the biggest problem we've always had is the politics of trying to secure things. Because securing things takes money, and getting money takes politics, right? It takes convincing decision makers. Tell me a little bit about how that battle has gone for you in the last 5 to 10 years.
So there's another angle which a lot of people miss. Offense is measurable.
Yes.
Defense is not.
Yes. Because you're measuring the lack of something.
Exactly. And,
yes.
Offense has actually done a brilliant job. Marketing has done a brilliant job of conveying this fact around that if you see that you're not hacked, you just don't know that you're not hacked.
Yes.
And yes. That brings the whole curtain down on the defense part, where to a larger extent, at a lot of places, I faced resistance, and this is not now, this is more of like in 5-6 years before this time frame,
yep,
where people were like, okay, what's the worst that can happen? And if you look at it that way, the entire InfoSec industry would have to like take a reality check on it.
Yeah.
Stock market does not care about security. Prices go down for 2 days and they come back up.
Yes.
And that the companies are still functioning. We can keep quoting down companies that have shut down, but there's very small percentage of those companies who are big enough that got shut down because there was a security incident. The other problem that came was that, hey, worst case scenario, if I have to pay fine, if I have to pay all of my customers something, what is that cost? And I've sat through those calculations where people are like, okay, what is the total cost of this breach that can happen? And then they'll basically calculate, okay, what's the cost of investment in defensive tooling? And then they'll be like, yeah, we're okay paying that cost.
Or they'll say, you know what, I'll just get cyber insurance.
Yeah.
Just get cyber insurance, you know.
So I think things have started to change now with the insurance also mandating and saying, hey, if a breach is because of negligence, we are not going to compensate.
Which makes sense, right?
Yeah,
because
yeah.
Car insurance, you know, they make sure that you have brakes on your car, right?
Yep,
they make sure that you have airbags, and, you know, so it doesn't make sense that you would get insurance, that any insurer would underwrite you if you don't protect yourself, if you don't do your due diligence, right?
The second thing I think has happened as a combination of multiple things. On one side, the rise of cloud came into picture, which gave access to resources which were not in reach to normal people, normal developers also. Parallelly, the whole as a code movement, which basically has containers, has virtual machines, all becoming part of the equation. And the movement around giving the recognition to free softwares and startups basically realizing that, hey, even if we don't succeed or survive for a very long time, our code will survive, and they open sourcing their code bases.
Yeah.
With that, basically what happened was the reasons why people were not investing in security. One of the most prominent reasons was that the tooling is all proprietary and we are going to be vendor locked in, and the tooling costs an arm and a leg.
Yeah.
So with open source tools, a lot of it can be homegrown, a lot of it could be home managed, and that's where the movement kind of took place, where now it is possible to actually hire a few people, give them the mandate to work on things. They don't have to work from scratch on everything. There are open source tools available. Use those tools, build the basic setup, and then you are moving into a better position. So to give the answer to your question, the journey has been progressively improving. While the initial days, the answer would be no on the face, to know it's too much costly, to now it's more of like, hey, is it fine if we are able to hire two people? Would they be able to manage it? Because we do want it, but can two people manage it? Can three people manage it? What is the number which we need to manage that? And the whole SaaS movement, although at times I feel like SaaS is a way to go to begin with, it's like cloud. When a company is starting, you should go for cloud. Get your bearings right, get to a point where cloud is becoming costly for you, then you move into your own data center. It's kind of the same journey for me for SaaS also. Companies starting up should actually just plug in into SaaS systems, get their bearings right, get their business running. Once the kitty is full, money is coming in, then slowly move the SaaS back into your in-house team. Because ultimately, you will be making decisions for yourself. The SaaS system would be making decisions for all the customers.
That's
so
right.
So it cannot have very focused, pinpointed stuff for you.
You lose a good amount of the control over essentially the fate of your product, really.
Yeah.
Right. Well, that's very interesting. But what I've also observed is yes, that's the question. What's the worst case scenario? And as you know, 2020, 2021, 2022, every year we get bigger and bigger loss numbers. Right?
Yeah.
And I don't understand why, of course, because we're here at the forefront, it frustrates me to see that leadership doesn't see that there's actually no upper limit to how much you can lose.
Yep.
Because actually, the more customers you have, the more you can lose, right? When we talk about cybercrime, we talk about breaches, right? Back in the day, a lot of the hackers used to just do it for fun, see if they could do it, see if they could break it. There were also hackers that were, hacktivists that were trying to make a message, trying to put a message out there, right? But today, hacking is an industry, right? It's a business, and it's all about making money. If it's not about geopolitics, it's about money, right? So if you're an organization, the more customers you have, for a hacker, that means the more money they can make and the more money you can lose. So I think that we're not, as an industry, we haven't yet illustrated this part of the formula to the leadership enough that there's actually no upper limit to how much they could lose.
Yep. Fully in agreement on that. One thing, so how I basically distinguish between the corporate side of hacking versus the fun and creative side, mm-hmm. I basically use the term InfoSec to represent anything which is related to job, which is related to making money with it. Mm-hmm. Hacking is something where I am basically just having a blast.
Ah, okay. Okay, that makes sense.
Yep.
Makes a lot of sense.
You're right on the money there that the upper limit does not exist.
Doesn't.
And the part about conveying it, and that's the problem that I'm trying to solve also at my side, mm-hmm. is how do you quantify, how do you put a number to the situation? And I think I've seen this frustration with a lot of my peers also. Mm-hmm. So growing up with the community has had a very good effect for me, that the Null community that you talked about in the introduction, I've been mm-hmm. associated with that since 2010, I think. So it's about 12 years now. Most of my peers who basically started at that level now are either head of product security or CISOs or people with decision-making power and people who are basically responsible to a product security at certain level.
Mm-hmm. This also crossed my mind, right? Because if we're not the first generation of cybersecurity professionals, we're probably the second, right?
Yep.
And when we started out, right, in the early 2000s, that's when both of us came into the game, right? In the early 2000s, me and you didn't care about money and bottom lines, right? We were just learning things, building or breaking things, right? Yep. We never even thought about having to explain why this is important to anybody.
Exactly.
Right? But now here we are, and like you said, we're CISOs, we're heads of product, we're heads of departments, right?
Yeah.
And now we're only just now being faced with this problem.
Yes.
And so I think that's why the problem, the solution, the clear-cut solution has not emerged yet.
It's not there. Yep.
Because our generation, who have come up through the ranks, are just now picking up the problem.
Yep.
We're just now picking it up, and we're saying, okay, we know what the value of this thing is. We know it's valuable. We know that we're not guessing that it's valuable. We know it's valuable. But they're not up there. They're not seeing it. What's missing, right? Because that's how we solve problems, right?
Exactly.
But the problem is we're just picking it up. And so I'm optimistic that sometime in the next 5 years, someone among us will figure out how to communicate it better.
Exactly.
Better than, this is the cost of a breach, you know? Because that's usually how we communicate it with scare tactics, right? And like you said, you can quantify attack, but you can't quantify defense. I think we're going to learn how to quantify defense in the future. I think, if we talk about physics and we look back in the day, they were talking about the Higgs boson particle, or they're talking about figuring out dark matter, right? I think in our industry, that's the big thing that everyone's facing. How do we quantify defense? How do we communicate the value? These are two things that if somebody among us figures it out, it's going to change the game.
It definitely is. There is another angle, which is more of a mindset change that all of us will go through. The analogy that I take is painting versus, say, medical profession.
Okay.
Medical is a science because there's a method to the whole madness, there is a set procedure that everyone has to follow. There is leeway that people can take, but there is a procedure that everyone has to follow.
Mm-hmm.
Painting, on the other hand, is an art. Everyone does it the way they want to do it.
Okay.
InfoSec right now sits more in the art category than in the science category. The more we move InfoSec from art to science, the more we'll be in the position to measure something, in the position to actually get the most benefit out of it.
I think that's very poignant. I think what I'm getting from that is that because technically the reason why they call medicine a science, right, is like you said, there's a tangible, solid guideline on how it's done today, right? There are best practices and XYZ. Painting, technically there are styles and there are different, you know, methods, but there's no one way to do it.
Right? Exactly.
So it's hard to communicate to non-art people why this painting is beautiful and that one is not, right?
And this is valuable, that is not.
Yes, and so with medicine, there are metrics that you can use to communicate to a non-medical person, this doctor is good and that doctor is not, right? You're right. I think that's a great point. So for those of you out there listening, right, we're looking for the road to turning information security into an actual science, right?
Yep.
That's awesome. And I never looked at it that way. That's a great analogy. So if I could just switch gears really quick, because I know I had one more thing on the docket I wanted to pick your brain about today. So another big thing in our industry right now, another big buzzword and another thing that everyone's worried about, not just the professionals, but also the non-professionals, it's supply chain risk, right? People worry about it, but a lot of people who are not in our industry, they're worried about it and they don't know why. So maybe you can start off by just telling us a little bit about why they should worry about it and what it actually is.
Okay, let me take a non-software example. So if there is food to be made at your house, all the ingredients have to be bought from the market. Mm. There's a vendor sitting in the market who basically sells you all the ingredients. Those ingredients are not created by that vendor. They're actually sourced from someplace else.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a whole chain that goes in. So if you remember the time when COVID struck, people were not able to find stuff at the local shops. And that's because the transportation was not working. And the big wholesalers were not able to send the stuff to the local retailers. So there was chain breakage. This whole chain that exists, which takes the stuff from fields to your house, is the supply chain. Now take that example, put that into your software development lifecycle. So by my own metrics, so this may be wrong, but my assumption and my observation so far is about 80% of what we call software products right now are basically import statements, which are basically calling in stuff that other people have done.
That somebody else built, yes, right.
So 80% of your product is actually developed by someone else and you're using that stuff. The modularization of programming language gave us the flexibility where I can write something and everyone else can use it. This originated from, if I'm not wrong, from the Unix philosophy of doing one thing right and then chaining multiple programs together to get the right outcome.
Mm-hmm.
So one of the best examples of that is curl. Curl right now is in every single place where human has ever touched. Be it Mars, be it Apollo, be it any space media, any media that has gone into undersea environments, curl has been there.
Yep.
So that's a software component which is needed by all the other tools to get some job done. all these ingredients are part of your software supply chain, because they are the components which are forming the whole equation. Now, the reason why we should care about supply chain security, because just like we cannot pick a food item from street and just randomly lying around in street and using it, we need to be aware of what we are digesting, what we are ingesting first, and rather not even digesting, what we are ingesting first.
Yes.
So whatever components we are importing, we should be aware of what they are, where they are coming from. So initial days, effectively very few people used to do open source. So there'll be very small number of publicly available modules. People will be struggling to find public modules. Somewhere down the line, people got this idea that, hey, if I put my code in public, I would get recognition. Recognition could equal to job. A job could equal to stable life for myself. So a lot of people jumped into open source. Right now, if you look at, say, college students, a lot of college students get this as an input that, hey, if you want to do something in tech, make some of your projects open source. Put your code out so that other people can see.
Be Linus Torvalds.
Yeah.
Be Linus Torvalds.
Yep. But what that also does is there is a lot of publicly available code which does not have any intentions of being maintainable, which does not have any intentions of being continuously worked on. But when you are looking at trying to find a module to use, you may end up finding it.
Yeah.
And you may end up using it. And if a bug comes in that code, you are not even aware that a bug exists in that code. And that can cause a problem.
And so, okay, so yeah, it makes sense, right? You don't know where your grapes come from. You don't know where your tomatoes come from, right? But that raises another question, right? The bigger question is, okay, well, if you're telling me that I don't know where all the groceries in my pantry come from, and they all come from different places and have components of things that come from different places, you've just presented me with such a huge problem, right?
Yep.
So how do we secure it? So, just in high level, broad strokes, what are your thoughts on how do we begin to even think about securing such a large volume of repositories and code?
So there are three aspects on it. One, you need to know what you're using. So there has to be a way to track what is it that constitute as components in your environment, which basically points to a recent keyword called SBOM, Software Bill of Material. Just like when you go to a carpenter or you go to a storekeeper and you say, okay, I want these, you give a list of items. So a software bill of material is list of items that are part of your software stack. So that's one piece. You need to know what your components are. Two, you should be able to query a database which has list of vulnerabilities. Now these databases are like NVDs or your local country specific vulnerability database might be there. You can query them to find if there are existing flaws in those components. So that's covering you from a situation where existing bugs are covered. So you're not basically using something which is already vulnerable. Part two, because the product is giving you value, you should be taking a portion of that value. And I'm not talking about huge percentages, maybe 2% of your profit, put that as a pushback to the open source communities. Use this fund in maybe two different manners. One could be directly support the developers. That, hey, you are developing something that I'm using. Here is my donation for that. And you ensure that there is food on their plate. They are in that position to work on things. Maybe, and this is something a lot of developers have now started doing, have a contract with that developer that, hey, since you are developing component for me, I am going to pay you a small sum. It's not going to be a life-changing sum, but I'm going to ensure there's a recurring sum that goes to you because your work is important to me. So put your money where your mouth is, sort of analogy. The another angle around it is, and this is all changing landscape. So I think about 2021 end is when US president basically gave a declaration out, or basically a statement saying the US government needs to be cautious about the software supply chain.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where SSDF framework came into picture. NIST developed SSDF because of that. Just recently, I think 3 or 4 days back, there was another public statement around cybersecurity. And there was a very interesting line in that. I don't recall the exact line, but to the effect, what they were saying was, it's not the responsibility of the open source developer to ensure their code is secure. Rather, it's the responsibility of the party which is getting the benefit out of it to ensure that the components are secure.
Totally on point. I think that's right on the nose, I think. I mean, because, you know, as you were mentioning, right, like, you know, some of these people, you know, you and I have worked with a lot of developers. A lot of developers don't actually do this for money.
Yep.
They do it for, they do it for the joy of creating.
Joy of it. Yep.
Right?
Yep.
So to ask somebody who created something 5 years ago to complete, to stay maintaining it, even if you pay them, they will not do it.
Yeah.
Because they've moved on to other projects that they're more interested in, right?
I have a fun example of it. Very recently, a lot of movement has happened from Twitter to Mastodon.
Mm-hmm.
One of the prominent clients of Mastodon is called Pinafore, P-I-N-A-F-O-R-E. Mm-hmm. It's a single page web application, which you can basically just go to the website, log in into your environment. You're not logging into the website. All the work is happening in your browser. It's all JavaScript based.
Wow.
And it works as a brilliant client.
Wow.
The moment Mastodon got popularity and people started raising issues in that repository, hey, we want this, we want this, we want this. The immediate reaction was, hey, you know what? I developed it because I wanted to do it.
Not for you.
I don't want to take the burden.
Yes.
I'm closing the chapter.
Yes. This is, I would say, it might be an unpopular opinion, but I would say that's the rule, not the exception. Most developers do not want to sit there and continue to work on the same project for 10 years, 15
definitely.
Years.
Definitely.
You know, even so, I watched a program the other day about the programming team behind Bitcoin.
Yep.
You know, there's I think 4 or 5 of them who tend to Bitcoin, but they consistently have to change their roster because the programmers get burned out and they don't want to work on. And Bitcoin's probably one of the most prominent things you could be working on today, and to be one of the 5 people tending to it, that's a big deal.
Yep.
But even to them, you know, it's not something they want to stay doing forever. You know?
Exactly. So that actually leads to the amount that I was talking about, reserve some amount. One of the ways is to actually incentivize the developers, the existing developers.
Mm-hmm.
The other approach is, and which is something that I've tried in my previous organization, reserve a time of your own employees to work on those projects.
That's an interesting
angle. Ensure that you put the code back, you put the contribution back, you help them back. Maybe find bugs and fix those bugs for them.
Mm.
Contribute. Instead of just being on a sideline, you be a part of that ecosystem.
But, you know, also, okay, so another thing I run into being an information security professional, right, when I have to deal with programmers, with developers, like you were mentioning earlier, the U.S. put out the SSDF, right? And, you know, Microsoft put out SSDLC, a decade and a half ago, maybe?
Yep.
A long time ago. And yet, you know, the clients that I work with, a lot of them are dev houses, and I couldn't pay them to follow the framework. I couldn't pay them.
Yep.
You know, they just need, you know, because, you know, and understandably, because they have deadlines, they have a sprint, they have to, you know, ship the code, right?
Yep.
So, you know, I've said it so many times on this podcast, you know, security takes a back seat. You know, and so I'm a little I'm a little skeptical about what an SSDF will do, unless it has to have teeth, I think. I think if we create something, it has to have teeth.
The teeth right now is, and that's where the fun comes. If you don't follow SSDF, you cannot be a contractor to US government.
Right, right. And that's...
So SSDF is a cascading requirement. So you as a vendor needs to follow it. Your vendors need to follow it. Their vendors need to follow it. So that's the teeth that exist.
That's I hope it works.
Yeah,
I really do.
That's the hope.
But I mean, you know, even if it doesn't work, that means me and you still have jobs, right? So I guess that's
definitely
okay too. I suppose that's also okay.
There is one more thing which a lot of people don't understand or realize about supply chain. So like I was talking about ingredients, we are focused on the ingredients. We are not focused on the fact that if the truck is not moving, the ingredients can't move.
That's right. And we saw this with COVID.
Yeah. The supply chain is not just the modules that you're importing. It's the IDE that you're using. It's the third-party SaaS library that you're using. It's the person sitting somewhere in a distant country managing the IAM policies for you.
Mm-hmm.
They also come in your supply chain problems.
All
of that has to be taken into consideration, because all of this combined together is giving you the final product. Any screw up at any level. So if you look at solar wind, I don't know if it's the final verdict, but the chain of event that I am aware of has been that there was a breach at JetBrains that led to an implant in one of their code software, which was then deployed into solar winds, which then allowed the attacker to plant a backdoor into Orion servers.
Mm-hmm.
Which were then planted into the Orion, to other Fortune 500 companies, and that backdoor was then executed. So, not even a direct attack on the Fortune 500s.
Back here in Orangi, a lot of us call it the perfect combo move.
Yeah.
it's one of the just that chain that led to that is. It started with a flicker, right? Like you said, it's just an everyday thing for something like JetBrain to get breached, right? But then it led to this crazy consequence. And again, that goes back to our original point that there is no upper limit to what a breach could cost, right?
There's no upper limit to what the breach can cost. And to the other point that you were making a few minutes back, because we are in that zone where it's art and it's not quantifiable. No one knows when to start, when to stop, how much to do. And that's where security is always going to take a backseat.
Yeah.
Till you can tell, hey, I'm going to need this much time and I can assure you 50% of secure setup or 70% of secure setup. If you give me more time, I can do it more. But to what percentages?
That's right.
If you can tell that, people would be happy to put that. Now, it's all ballparks.
It's all just guessing, right? And,
yes.
And that's kind of, you know, we're all kind of having to deal with it on that level until somebody, like I said, one of us comes up with some way to turn it into a science, like you said. I think... that's a fantastic point. Something I'd never looked at it from that perspective before. Is that the time? Oh, we're actually coming up to 50 minutes, which is probably one of the longest I've ever done one of these. And I think we have enough to talk about to do another full session. Unfortunately, I'm going to have to cut it off there. But I guess as a last question, Anant, you know, we've gone all over the world today in subject matter. But if there was one last thought you wanted to give all of our viewers and listeners today, what would that be?
a fun one. All the offensive people start toning down your expectations and start looking at the other side and making the judgment calls that, hey, what you think as super critical may not even be required to be implemented from a dev's perspective. And for the developers, start ranking up the bugs what you think is not a problem at all because you're going to decommission it in 2 months. Listen to what the other person is saying and meet the middle grounds.
Oh, I love it. I love it. Meet in the middle, guys. That's the last thought we got from Anant today. Anant, I'm going to, you know, I'll ask you, I'm going to invite you again in the future. Let's talk more about these things. It was fantastic. It was such a joy having you.
Thanks a lot for having me, Mark.
Thank you. Thank you. And for all of you out there, check us out at harangi.com for more information security, more material, more Ask a CISO podcast episodes. Other than that, we'll see you on the next one.
Howdy.